From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, the latest on the effort to legalize medical marijuana in Utah. It seems all the legal obstacles have been cleared and the political maneuvering is over for now. A ballot measure to allow the therapeutic use of cannabis will be before voters in November. So we're talking about the campaign for it and, of course, the arguments against. Join us in just a moment.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most people probably agree that using marijuana in some form for certain medical conditions could help for chronic pain or sleep issues or arthritis, epilepsy. And so it seems the critical question at the center of the debate over medical marijuana in Utah isn't whether it should be allowed, but how you do it. Is the initiative that will be before voters in November the right way to do it? Does it take into account the risks? Does it have enough restrictions? Is it really motivated by medical concerns, or is this a slippery slope toward legalizing recreational pot? Today in the program, we're talking about where we are in this debate over medical marijuana, which has stretched out over years now. We'll begin with the reporter Taylor Anderson of the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been following the story for the paper. Let's start with, I guess, one of the latest developments in the story. The opponents of the initiative, they had filed this lawsuit to stop the process. Early last month, it was now, they withdrew that suit. Where does that put us? Where are we now in terms of the story? It seems like we're moving forward.
Yeah, that was kind of the last roadblock before this thing actually goes to November. The group, a group of opponents, had asked a judge. It got moved into federal court. They said, this is a federally illegal plant. The lieutenant governor cannot put this thing on the ballot, so stop it right here. Before that even had a hearing, the group decided, you know, we probably don't have standing on this yet. It's not a law. It's just an idea until voters have a say one way or the other.
So that's what they meant when they said it didn't have it lacked ripeness.
That's right. Yeah. You couldn't challenge it yet. So they backed out. They asked the court to withdraw the case. You know, there's still the potential that serious opponents could file again and try and see where that process goes. But for now, there's no actual thing standing in the way from voters to having a say on this. It's already been certified for the ballot. They collected enough signatures. It's all green lights from here.
You've described this in your writing as the most contested measure on the ballot in November. That seems clear. Where does it fit, though, this issue more broadly? How significant is something like this? Like, is this a big deal?
It's a big deal because of the makeup of the state. Yeah. Because the way that the LDS Church members, the LDS Church has interpreted the word of wisdom, its guidance for dietary and other practices by members, is to include illegal substances on its list, and the abuse of prescription medications that might be legal. They say don't use illegal substances. Marijuana, technically, federally, it is illegal. Yeah. It's legal medically in other states, recreationally in other states, but in Utah right now, it's not. So that's where. You know, this gains more significance. You know, more than half the state is LDS. So, if this is a drug that the church has said, it's kind of on that list of do not use, then and it still looks like it's on its way to potentially passing, or at least it polls favorably now. It's more significant than maybe another conservative state saying, yeah, let's give this a try.
Did the pace of this surprise you at all? I mean, or does this seem about right when you look at other states and their development of medical marijuana laws?
You know, in Utah, it's been smoldering a little bit for several years. And advocates have actually tried their chances in the legislature. Because it's actually kind of tough to reach the ballot in Utah. So, you know, the main way to make laws or change laws is through the legislature. So for the past few years, they went up there to Capitol Hill and said, will you pass medical marijuana? And they got close. They passed it through the Senate, but the House was not going along with it. So the closest was in 2016. And so, while it's somewhat surprising that it's polling so high, 2/3 support right now.
Yeah.
We've actually been kind of debating this for a few years. This is just the first time that the wider public has an actual thing to debate. It's coming to our mailbox and onto our ballot this November. What do we think about that? That's the first time that we've had this. So in that way, it's been speeding up, but it's been around for a few years.
Did lawmakers get a sense of the momentum of this thing? It seems like they've been trying to stop it, trying to keep it from, you know, there are all these, they don't like, for the most part, initiatives like this, or maybe that's a broad statement, but they try attempts at dealing with that kind of thing. And they tried it this year as well, it looks like.
They did, yeah. I mean, after that, the number of years, and the advocates were still out there saying, we want patients to have medical marijuana in Utah. We're going to go to the ballot, you know, strike however many chances that they didn't pass it through the legislature. They started a campaign. They started collecting signatures, and they were doing quite well collecting those. So when the legislature saw that and the momentum behind it, they said, okay, we're going to go. We're going to dip our – I think the sponsor of the legislation said we'll dip our pinky toe in the water here because it is still federally illegal. But we will pass it for anybody – who has an estimated 6 months or less to live, and they can, with their doctor's recommendation, try medical marijuana. It's not up and running yet, but they passed that in February, March in the session. And that was their attempt to say, look, we're listening. We see the support out there. Here's our go on this plant.
What happens to that law if the initiative passes?
We'll have to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I know... Yeah, a bunch of attorneys are probably already poring over this. But the thing about
we don't know, but
the thing about initiatives is that it goes right back up. This law is open for the legislature to tinker around with, to add regulations. They could repeal it if they wanted. It's an initiative. It's not a constitutional change.
Yeah.
So this happens in other states where something is put on the books, the legislature changes the book. That's their purview and so if they kind of morph the two, you know, that's up to them, given the political pressure they'll be under if the voters pass this thing. But it's hard to say right now.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the polling that you've been doing along with the Hinckley Institute. So 2 in every 3 Utah voters is backing the campaign, as you mentioned. But the numbers are moving a bit, and I'm wondering what you make of that. I mean, it seems like people are changing their minds a little. I mean, the polling has dropped, what, like 10 points so
far? Right, right. Because it had been consistently 3 out of 4. About 3 out of 4 voters had supported this. Now it's down to 2 out of 3. And what had happened between the 3 out of 4, you know, those polls is that an actual opposition campaign had formed and started making public comments and spending money to try to, you know, knock that down. It looks like they were successful. The church had issued a couple of statements saying, you know, we've got concerns. They didn't say go vote against this, but we have concerns. And our polling showed that it had an effect on active LDS members more than any other group in the state. So that's a good sign that, you know, as a campaign gets going on both sides, it can sway public opinion on this.
Is it too early to say, and I'm not sure if you can even gather this information from the numbers you had, that it's still moving, that the numbers still may be shifting? Can you tell?
We might not know until the next poll comes out.
Yeah. 11% said the church's position actually made them want to support the initiative. What's that about?
Well, you know, if you look at it, there was, voters who were not LDS. They were actually driven, I think 25-30% said, that's the church's position.
I'm going against it.
The opposite.
Wow.
You know, active, somewhat active. The members were listening. You know, some of them surprisingly said, you know, I'm actually going to support this now. I wasn't maybe before. But it had a much greater effect on members than it did on non-members. It drove them toward the ballot for sure.
I want to ask you about what do you think the role of the what do you make, I guess, of the role of the LDS Church during all of this? How aggressive have they been in terms of their lobbying? You mentioned the, I guess it was a statement. It wasn't much of a statement that they issued a few months ago. I'm just saying things like, the legal analysis that we've seen has raised some, I think, grave concerns is how they put it. They talked about the potential for compromising health and safety standards, those kinds of things. But I can't tell if they don't seem terribly aggressive.
Right. And I've tried to figure it out. It's hard to guess what the church is or isn't going to do.
Yeah.
So you have to look at past elections and say, well, how has the church acted when there's an initiative at hand? People point to Proposition 8 in California, where the church actually came out and said, members, help to pass this.
Yeah.
Spend your money, go door to door, actively work on this. They haven't done that here. And from what I was told, they don't like to do that. Church leadership just kind of stays in the background. They don't like the appearance of being politically active. And so they—
The appearance anyway, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. They do a lot of this under the radar, it seems.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell?
Well,
like were there lobbyists up on the Hill, for example, working this issue for the church?
Not that I saw. Yeah. Not behind the bill that actually passed. But back to their statements, they said they've been a little bit more tepid. They've been saying, they've made it clear that this isn't their cup of tea.
Yeah.
But they said they had grave concerns. They said they pointed to the Utah Medical Association, which is kind of the leader of the opposition campaign right now. And they've come out hard against it. And the church said, we support our doctors. They have some important things to say here. These that we, again, have concerns.
Yeah.
Not go vote against this, but we as church leadership are concerned.
The Mormon scholar and observer Matthew Bowman talked to you, and he told you that he didn't think this was a hill that church leaders wanted to die on.
He was looking again at Proposition 8,
yeah,
and also the attempt back in the 30s. I think it was the 30s that prohibition was overturned. The church had said, "Legislature, don't be the deciding vote on this. We like prohibition. Let's keep it that way." And Utah went and voted to overturn prohibition, anyways. So
there's the deciding state.
The deciding state. That's
yeah.
Right. So those were two big issues, even though one was before most voters were alive. That we can point back to in the timeline, and this professor thought, they're not going to try to do that again.
The opposition, as you mentioned, centered around the Utah Medical Association. Is that typical? As far as you can tell, that it's the doctors that. And when these initiatives or these ideas come out in states are the ones that tend to be opposed to it?
The National Medical Association is not in favor because of the testing, the lack of – it's a federally illegal drug that doctors will be technically – you have to call it recommending.
Yeah.
It's their version of prescribing a federally illegal plant. So until we get to where we've got FDA-approved drugs, the medical associations are not going to be on board. Typically, it's them, it's law enforcement, it's legislators who are kind of make up the bulk of opposition campaigns.
Are they spending a lot of money, as far as you can tell, in opposition?
Not yet. There's been maybe a few $100,000, which I guess, depends who you ask if that's a lot of money.
That doesn't seem like a lot of money.
Not yet.
Yeah.
And it's been a few weeks since the last reporting deadline. So we'll have to see if there's been a lot more action since then. But the funding has come from one man who has been in the state, Walter Plum. He's an attorney. He got his hands in a few different things, and he's been, on this issue for a while. He actually wrote checks for over $100,000 to help get the opposition going. And it's too soon to say how much, if we'll get into the millions, I don't know. The initiative process in Utah is not as well used to give us a track record as it is in other states. So we'll have to see on the money aspect.
I wanted to ask you about one of the contentions against the initiative, that this idea that it's being driven by an industry that stands to make billions. This is one of the contentions. And in that sense, it seems like they're comparing it, and that may be an effective strategy, to tobacco.
I guess so. And it is a hot point in states that have legalized both medically and recreationally. What are the requirements? What are the what's allowed in terms of financing behind this? And we see there are countries that have been – like Canada, for instance. There are companies that have been operating there for much longer than we have had cannabis companies in the U.S. And so when the market expands, they see an opportunity to make money. I think there's truth that we might see either out of state or possibly out of country people, companies come and get an interest in making money on this industry if it's created in Utah. Even at the rulemaking for the legislature's law, medical marijuana law, you know, there were people from other states, from California, saying, "Hey, we grow this really well in California or Oregon. We'd like to grow it really well here." I haven't seen billions. I haven't seen that amount of backing. But one other thing is there's a national group called the Marijuana Policy Project, and they are based out of Washington, D.C., with a stated goal of expanding legalized marijuana across the United States. They are involved. They are backing this as best they can and donating money. So there's a national group, and I can see where some of that rhetoric is coming from there.
We should, I guess, mention the kind of ironic point that the state itself makes a lot of money taxing liquor, something that, again, is seen as a kind of moral failing by the LDS Church. It's kind of interesting, and I guess that's one of the arguments that comes up from time to time is, look, states can make a lot of money off of this regulating and taxing it.
They can. This won't, because you will not charge sales tax on the state will not be allowed to charge sales tax on medical marijuana sales.
No states can. It's because it's a federal law, right? I mean,
the financing is complicated.
Yeah.
They can tax recreationally. It's just the banking is where it becomes an
they
issue.
They have to use cash or something.
Right, right, exactly. And there's talk in Congress of maybe dealing with that, but not yet. So there's not going to be a windfall in Utah, you know,
anytime soon.
As this initiative is written, right?
Right, for sure.
Right. It's fee-based. It's supposed to be revenue neutral, which just means that the fees for people trying to open a dispensary, trying to grow it, trying to test it, they will cover the cost for the Department of Agriculture to run it. So,
let me ask you this finally. Are you getting a sense, Taylor, that there's a kind of momentum at play, not just in Utah but around the country? You mentioned in your writing, Oklahoma voters recently approved a measure, medical marijuana measure. You've got recreational use in Nevada and Colorado nearby. When you talk to people, do you get a sense that there is some kind of momentum at play?
Well, it's hard not to look at the map of legalization in the U.S. and seeing the momentum, actually. You know, when advocates started this, I just saw this morning, Christine Stenquist, who's with Truce Utah, she wrote on Facebook, you know, in 2014, I was up at the legislature. People called me crazy for proposing this and thinking that it would actually get done. Since 2014, 8 states have legalized medical marijuana, and that's conservative states, Arkansas, like Oklahoma just recently approved it. Montana, they've had it for a little bit, but they got rid of it and voters brought it back. Mm. You know, 8 states are now legal for people 21 and up. That's all happened in the last 5 years. So it's been changing rapidly. There's not been action in Congress so much, but it's been moving for sure. It's hard to deny the momentum.
Any sense? I won't ask you to predict what's going to happen in November, but where do you think it's trending right now, if you were to guess?
Well, as our poll shows, you know, it lost about 10% support. We'll have to see what, you know, if there's money spent against, how much money is spent in favor. People seem to have made up their minds. About 5% were unsure. And so that means that the campaign, if against, is going to have to convince people that now your initial position was wrong. We'll have to see.
Yeah. It's Taylor Anderson. He's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune covering government. He's reported extensively on this medical marijuana issue, and we have a link to his coverage on our website, radiowest.org. Joining us now on the program is Connor Boyack. He's the president of the Libertas Institute. It's a libertarian think tank in Utah. Libertas has been involved in the drafting of the medical marijuana initiative that Utahns will vote on this fall. He joined us from his office in Lehi, and we began with a story from a few years ago. Libertas had been working with Utah Senator Mark Madsen on a medical marijuana bill. Boyack takes it from there.
You know, we met with, as they are kind of nicknamed on Capitol Hill, the home teachers. These are the official lobbyists for the LDS Church, of which I myself am a member. It was myself and Senator Madsen and these two gentlemen who had been sent to tell legislative leadership that they would be opposing the bill that Senator Madsen and our organization were working on together to try and legalize medical cannabis in Utah. They were then extending Senator Madsen, the sponsor of the bill, the courtesy of letting him know that they had just informed legislative leadership that they were in opposition to the bill. Their concerns were, you know, well, we don't think this is tested. It's not FDA approved. We don't like that it has THC. We think this is going a little too fast. And when we sought an opportunity to address those concerns, we were unfortunately denied.
Tell me what you mean by that. I mean, this is something that you were frustrated by, that they didn't, what, want to engage you on the particular questions themselves?
Well, the concern was that, you know, the Utah Medical Association and other opponents kind of had their ear. They were feeding them a line that we felt was completely mischaracterizing the issue. And our side, our perspective was not did not have an opportunity to be presented. We specifically requested a meeting with a senior church official, an apostle, somebody on the committee considering this, and were just flat out told that that wouldn't be happening. They had made up their mind already, despite not reviewing any of the substantial material we had about how much research has been done around the world, especially in Israel. We just never got the chance, and that was unfortunate. So we feel like the decision that was made then and the decisions that are being made now by the LDS Church are rather one-sided and don't have the full picture of what's actually happening.
So you don't think the church's position has evolved that much from that experience you had 3 years ago?
You know, not that I've seen. The only thing that's really changed is that there's definitely this kind of acceptance, more broadly speaking, of cannabis as a medicine. Even our fiercest opponents now concede to their constituents or the media, oh, I support medical cannabis, you know, but just not the initiative or just not going too fast. So whether we're talking about the opponents we have in the legislature or even the LDS Church, we feel that there's definitely this openness towards the vague concept of medical cannabis. But then, of course, the devil's in the details, and there's specific opposition now to the initiative or Proposition 2 that voters will be considering in November.
You mentioned when you were writing about this a few years ago that you were then worried about the LDS Church's opposition. Are you still as worried right now when you look at the polling numbers? I mean, they're dropping some, but there still seems to be a majority of Utahns who support this initiative.
I think any of the initiatives on the ballot this year or any initiatives anywhere in the country would be ecstatic to have the polling numbers that we currently do, even after this supposed dip. You know, so we're not worried, first of all. Second of all, I've been in politics long enough to know that an isolated poll can largely depend on the way it was asked, the wording of the question.
Right.
And so for us, we look at the polling more generally. Certainly we'll be interested to see the next poll or two that come out to see if there is any trend or if this was an isolated thing. Even if we're going down a little bit, we still have a very safe margin, and we're very confident that as the campaign heats up in the next few months, as patients are sharing their stories more prominently in the media, social media, and online with their friends, we're very confident that those stories will be well-received. Our polling numbers will remain strong. So I'm not worried in the sense that our opposition is going to, you know, kill the initiative and overturn our efforts. I'm more worried from the sense that I feel like the public is being misinformed by the opposition, that our efforts are being mischaracterized, and that those who are opposing what we're doing don't really have that full and complete picture that we wish they would.
What do you think is the basic misunderstanding? If you think that essentially what you're after is being mischaracterized, what point to one of the things that you think is not understood or being distorted?
You know, I could point to five or six for purposes of time, and because our opponents keep kind of dancing around different arguments, they have shifted their what they oppose and what they claim. I'll use the most recent one since it's likely that's what your listeners will be hearing, and that is that this is a recreational effort, that we, the backers of the Prop 2, are actually masking recreational marijuana inside the medical cannabis initiative, that our organization, Libertas Institute, that MPP, that our donors are doing this because we want recreational, that the wording of the initiative is you know, really recreational, that there's loopholes and backdoors. All of this is utter and complete nonsense. It's simply not true. From my vantage point behind the scenes, I know who drafted this. I know who had input. I know what our donors want. This is a strictly medical program. If we wanted recreational, not only would it completely fail, because the polling numbers for that are in the low 20s, you know, but I'm an extremely transparent person in the sense that I advocate for what I believe in, and I'm very clear about what we want. This is not a recreational initiative. This is strictly medical. Americans for Safe Access and other organizations view Proposition 2 as the most conservative program. It is extremely tightly regulated. And, of course, our opponents have to, like, pick at a little word here and a misinterpretation there so as to make their case. But when you view it more broadly, when you understand the intent, the motive behind it, this is a strictly medical program, and we look forward to definitely making that case to the voters and helping them understand it.
One of the arguments you hear is that there aren't enough restrictions in the initiative. And the question of whether or not Utah's law is somehow different, looser than other states in terms of what you're saying is, in fact, quite the contrary.
It is the contrary. Of course, you know, our opponents don't really provide context. They'll say things like, oh, my heavens, you can have up to 4 ounces that you can get from the dispensary, not pointing out that in many other medical cannabis states where you don't see this profound abuse, you don't see big problems, patients can get more. They'll put it in terms of this is how many marijuana cigarettes that people are getting, but patients aren't smoking it. That's not allowed in Proposition 2. You have a lot of people who are, you know, tossing cannabis in their smoothies. They're consuming raw flour, not heating it, which is what activates the psychoactive component. And so they need a lot of raw material. They need to, you know, especially like a cancer patient. And so, you know, they don't give that context. They just say that, oh, my heavens, 4 ounces sounds scary, so this is going to be how we try and alarm people. But when you actually put it in context, when you see what other states have done and how we have learned from their mistakes, we've learned from the dangers of recreational states like California or Colorado. We've incorporated protections and restrictions in Proposition 2 so as to minimize any chance of abuse, so as to minimize any of the problems. And so it's unfair to point to other states and say, we don't want to end up like them. You have to read the initiative. You have to understand precisely what we're doing, because if you just go off of claims without context, you'll be misled.
What are the mistakes you've seen in other states like California or Colorado?
You know, one of the problems we saw early on was that edibles were a very popular way for people to consume cannabis. And you had, especially in Colorado, but elsewhere, you had some manufacturers that were taking pre-existing products, let's say a piece of candy, and then they would spray a cannabis oil substance onto a pre-made food that people didn't really understand what that was. The labeling was not that good. And so we've made sure, right, that you can't spray onto things. You can't have it look like candy or anything appealing to kids. Everything has to be clearly labeled. And so these are the types of examples where, as people would point out legitimate problems, problems where children might get it or people might misunderstand what it was, we wanted to incorporate that. I'm not here, Doug, to argue that Proposition 2 is perfect. It's a learning process. In drafting Proposition 2, we took what we were working on with Senator Manson and just tweaked it a bit. So this is largely what had a lot of input during the legislature, but it's not an end result. We're definitely going to be at the table with lawmakers for years to come, I imagine, refining this, closing loopholes, identifying problems, and offering solutions to make sure that patients get what they need, they're not turned into criminals, and that we minimize abuse for anyone who shouldn't be getting this stuff.
What is it we don't know about marijuana, do you think? Because this is one of the arguments that I'm guessing we'll hear and that we are hearing, that physicians don't know really how to prescribe or recommend it safely, that they don't understand or can't really talk about dosing guidelines or contraindications, that we don't know enough. I wanted to get your response to that.
Many doctors don't. And it's unfortunate to see many people defer to the Utah Medical Association as the voice of the doctors. We have many doctors in our network who have been researching, who do understand dosing, who understand contraindications and the amounts that their patients should have. Doctors who are putting in the work. You know, medical schools aren't talking about this, so most doctors are unfamiliar with it. But to have the Utah Medical Association make these broad statements when, in fact, they only represent a minority of physicians in Utah, and that they didn't even poll their members when they were talking about whether they would oppose our efforts or not. We have, you know, a board member or two of UMA who supports Proposition 2. So this is more a quixotic quest by, you know, a narrow subset, when in fact, if you talk to doctors more broadly, there are some who are very interested, especially physicians in kind of the pain management practice. They're seeing what opiates has done to ravage our society. They're exploring alternatives. They're reading the latest scientific literature. Israel is light years ahead of where we are in understanding cannabis. So there are physicians who are learning, who are understanding. We think that them and their patients should simply have the freedom to figure out what works, as we all support more research, more understanding. You know, give it a decade or two, we're going to be light years ahead of where we are now. But our simple contention is that between now and then, when we better understand everything about cannabis, we just want to make sure that patients have the freedom to try and that they aren't considered criminals for simply trying to become more healthy. We all want more research. We all want more understanding. But until we get to that point where we're satisfied, we have to fix the criminal law.
How do you respond, Connor, to the question, and I hear this from time to time, that the idea of the potential for marijuana to impair a driver or people is not talked about enough, that this is one of those concerns? And I'm wondering, how are you talking about that?
You know, I think this is part of a broader discussion in which we talk about distracted driving more generally. We have a lot of problems right now with alcohol, with texting, and even with legal substances such as opiates and other pharmaceuticals. So the problem is more broad. That's not to say that just because there could be a problem with impaired driving and cannabis, that therefore we should ban cannabis. We're very supportive of trying to make sure that people are driving safely, that they're not impaired. But that's a separate and broader discussion than the one that talks about legalizing cannabis. It's actually a very interesting thing, though, with cannabis, where you can, after ingesting a substance, ingesting cannabis, you can have a metabolite, the remnants of that cannabis, in your body for up to a month. And so what we're seeing right now in some cases is that a medical refugee will go to Colorado, perhaps for the weekend, to try and stop their seizures. They'll spend a few days there. They'll return to Utah. A week later, 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, they can be pulled over. If the officer, for any reason, suspects something, they do a blood draw or saliva, they find that metabolite, and then that individual is charged with DUI, even though they were not actively impaired by that cannabis metabolite, it just happened to be in their system. So cannabis is a bit of a unique thing when it comes to operating a vehicle because that metabolite hangs out for so long. That's another area of the law that Proposition 2 is looking to begin addressing because it's a bigger problem.
Let me ask you finally this. What is your sense of the where the momentum might be headed here? As you mentioned, it's hard to say from polling and exactly what that might or might not reveal. But I'm wondering what kind of work you figure you have cut out for yourself in the next couple months here.
I think from a default standpoint, we feel very comfortable and confident. When you look at the polling more broadly, when you look at the work we've been doing, the signatures we got and how quick we got them, the amount of volunteers helping, when you look in the full context, the big picture, we're very confident. Of course, we're not going to rest. We're going to actively push back against our opposition and the mischaracterizations we feel they're making about our efforts. But what this often boils down to is get out the vote. Who's going to be turning out to vote? What is vote by mail going to be doing? And when you look at the dynamics of what's going to be happening in November, especially multiple other ballot initiatives, a very hotly contested race with Mia Love and Ben McAdams, these are going to draw out a different subset of voters that may lean a little less conservative in many of these issues, which probably favors the medical cannabis initiative more than the polling is revealing. And so we're very confident not only as a default that we're going to win, but even looking at what the get out the vote efforts are going to look like in November, we think that that probably is a net positive for us. We think our opposition is going to have a really tough time getting people to argue that patients should continue to be criminalized, that they should be denied this medicine. We just think that's an uphill battle. We expect to win, and we're very hopeful that patients soon are going to have the relief they've been fighting for here in Utah for years.
Connor Boyack is president of the Libertas Institute. That's a local libertarian think tank. It's been instrumental in getting the medical marijuana measure on the voting ballot in November. He joined us from his office in Lehigh. We'll take a break. Be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER is working harder than ever to tell Utah stories with podcasts. You can take Doug Fabrizio's thoughtful Radio West interviews wherever you go, see how deep our reporters' work goes with more to say, and keep up with Utah politics on 45 Days. Listen to the stories you love on your own time, and we'll keep you up to date about new projects, too. Search for KUER wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about just where we are in this debate over medical marijuana in Utah. Joining us now on the program is Michelle McComber. She is the CEO of the Utah Medical Association, also a director of Drug Safe Utah. Both of those organizations are opposed to the medical marijuana measure. I wanted to begin with one of the contentions of Connor Boyack just a moment ago, when one of the things he said was that opponents are dancing around this issue, that in the past they've talked about it as not being medicine, but now the idea is changing. They're not opposed to the idea of cannabis being a potential for, you know, being medicinal, but they're now opposed to the initiative itself. I wanted to give you a chance, first of all, to respond to that, that you're dancing around the issue.
That's not true. So we've never been dancing around the issue. We've always been opposed to the initiative. We've never said that the medical marijuana, true medical marijuana, is not true. We've never said that we are opposed to medical cannabis, particular components of medical cannabis. And in fact, in 2014, we were up there fighting for the bill that passed. And every year we've been up there negotiating on different bills and doing it in a safe and effective way, in a way that is proven by science, not a way that is done through an initiative.
In a recent statement, you said this is not about medicine.
That's right. The initiative is not about medicine. So the initiative, regardless of what Connor says, was written by a marijuana policy project. We have the documents that have marijuana policy project signature on it. We know it was written by Marijuana Policy Project. Marijuana Policy Project is the Washington, D.C. group, marijuana group, that wants recreational marijuana across the United States. That is their stated goal. It's not hidden. That's their stated goal. And as you look at the initiative, as you go through it very thoroughly and very carefully, that is their stated goal, and that's what they want, and that is what they have put in the initiative. By everything that they've done and every little piece that you look at, you can see that.
Explain that. How are you seeing a move toward recreational use in that initiative?
Okay. So the first piece is the affirmative defense. So if it goes into effect in November, the first day after it goes into effect, for the first 19 months of the initiative, there all you have to do is claim that you would get a medical marijuana card and you are home free to use, to possess, to grow, to do anything with marijuana. Okay. So that's the first piece. That's full out recreational right there. Okay. Then in terms of a medical marijuana card, because physicians can't prescribe, it's not allowed because it is a Schedule I substance, right? The only piece is they would recommend a card. That is the only piece in terms of their involvement in what happens with the patient. Then the patient goes to a dispensary run by the marijuana industry, not by the state, not really even regulated, because if you look at what's the regulation under the initiative, there's very little regulation in the initiative. So it's run by marijuana and industry. And then they sell the patient whatever they want, whatever they convince the patient to pick up. And included in that is it's for children. Okay. Very concerning to us, the children. Any THC level or content can be sold to somebody who's 18. And by the way, in other states, it's 21, not 18. 18, and they can pick up any product for their kids, including full THC products. The THC products, so tetrahydrocannabinol, are the ones that damage the brain and the development of the brain until somebody is 26. That's very concerning to us. Another piece is unlimited possession in homes. Okay, he talked about the 4 ounces in a month, but they have a little caveat in there where they said nothing about homes. So you have unlimited possession in homes. If you don't have a medical cannabis card, okay, it's only a $100 fine. So you can very easily get around that. Go to Colorado, go wherever, and get whatever you want, bring it back, and it's only a $100 fine. There's all these little pieces in there that actually skirt around the fact that it is not medical marijuana.
I wanted to mention a few of what might be the counterpoints to the idea that there aren't very many restrictions. The initiative does keep these prohibitions on the public use of cannabis, like driving under the influence. They have an electronic verification system administered by the Department of Health that could track all of this.
Is destroyed in 30 days.
Okay.
All records destroyed in 30 days.
They establish restrictions on businesses within schools and parks and playgrounds, even churches. They have inventory control systems.
Let's mention the schools, parks, playgrounds, what have you, okay? The only restriction is 600 feet from schools, parks, and playgrounds, okay, and churches. 600 feet. That's the only restriction. You cannot have any local control about dispensaries other than that. It has to be 600 feet from that. 300 feet from neighborhoods. That's it. No other local control at all.
So would you just take me through a kind of a worst case scenario here? In your statement, you say that there would be an influx of less than honorable practitioners happy to recommend marijuana to anyone who asks. So your worst case scenario that you're imagining is a kind of free for all,
mm-hmm.
basic recreational use.
Right. There is no requirement for a practitioner. And by the way, physician is not just a physician. A physician includes dentists. It includes optometrists, so those who recommend eyeglasses, right? It includes podiatrists, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, etc. So let's get that out there. So it's not just physicians. It's a whole group.
So what do you mean? That it should only be physicians?
It should only be physicians.
Why?
We're talking about a Schedule I substance, okay? We're talking about an addictive substance. We're talking about something that has THC in it.
Now, there are arguments about whether it's addictive, of course.
Yeah. Not from addiction specialists.
And there are a lot of arguments.
Not from those who do the research on the THC side of things.
Right.
If we're talking
about
a cannabidiol. You're right. The cannabidiol side of things, absolutely. THC side of things, no. I mean, it's out there in the literature.
It's not settled. No. I think you know that.
Well, no. I think we're pretty clear that there's an addictive factor in there.
Are there things that could fix that initiative that would make you be supportive? Are there ways to fix these things enough to where you could allow some kind? I mean, I know you were supportive of the legislation that was proposed and passed this year. So it seems to me that yes, you see some fixes that could be done.
This initiative is so horrible that I don't see fixes in this initiative. You know, we've been working through things through the legislature. We passed cannabidiol oil for those who have intractable epilepsy. We passed cannabidiol oil, period, in the state of Utah. We passed medical cannabis for the terminally ill. We are looking at different things, but doing it in a safe and effective and efficient way that does not create more harm. That's what we want to see. What you see in other states that pass initiatives is then when you try to come back and pull things in, you see the marijuana industry come out with lawsuits and what have you to pull it back and say, no, you can't do that. This is the will of the people. So you want to be very careful about that. You know, I do want to address something that Connor said about our board and stuff, too. I think, you know, I want to get to that point, too.
Yeah, I want to give you a chance to respond to that. What he's saying is that you're not speaking for all doctors, that you didn't, in fact, pull your doctors when you made the decision to oppose the initiative.
So we have a House of Delegates meeting where we poll physicians who represent their groups, their hospitals, where they represent their specialties from across the whole Utah. And we have a House of Delegates meeting, and we came together and we talked about talking about medical cannabis and talking about whether or not we would go for an initiative or bypassing the FDA process and all of those things. We did indeed do that. And we had a vote, and it was voted down.
Polled representatives, but did you poll the members?
We polled the members very early on cannabis, yes.
When?
We polled the members in, I want to say, well, before the initiative came out, but on this very issue about medical cannabis.
Well, I guess the contention that he's saying is you didn't poll your members about this initiative. He's right about that, isn't he?
Well, you know, again, we did the House of Delegates, which are the one, you know, they send their representatives to look at these issues and vote on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have leadership and committees and everybody else who have been elected to make those decisions, too.
There was something else you wanted to respond to in terms of what he said about the board?
Yeah, he also said two board members supporting. That is not true. Absolutely not true.
No board members at all?
No board members.
Okay. You say there's not enough control over what a patient could potentially receive. You mentioned those kinds of things.
Right.
How do you weigh, Michelle, the concerns against the possible benefits? Obviously, children who have severe illnesses, including epilepsy, a lot of talk about this as being some kind of potential solution, if not antidote, to the opioid epidemic. How are you weighing those, I guess, potential benefits against the concerns that you have for this initiative?
Well, we'd really like to see the evidence that this does anything on the opioid epidemic. You know, we have states that have passed medical marijuana, and we're seeing more opioid deaths than ever in many of those states. Some of the states that have marijuana, we're seeing decreases. A lot of the states that don't have medical marijuana, we're seeing decreases. We don't see any correlation between that. And in fact,
you don't think marijuana is
it's not the answer. No. In fact, a recent 4-year study looking at both opioids and marijuana says, in conclusion, cannabis use is common in people with chronic non-cancer pain who have been prescribed opioids. We found no evidence that cannabis use improved patient outcomes. Those who used cannabis had greater pain and lower self-efficacy in managing pain. Furthermore, we found no evidence cannabis use reduced pain, interference, or exerted an opioid-sparing effect.
So you don't put any stock in some of the anecdotes that I'm sure you've heard that were offered up at the legislature, in fact, this past session, that said people were able to use marijuana to ease back pain as opposed to opioids, which were clearly addictive.
You know, anecdotal stories are why we start studies, right? Why we do studies, why we look at if there's efficacy for it.
And but that's not real science,
and
is what you're saying.
It's not real science, but it is an appropriate reason to look at it and say, does this work? And that's why University of Utah is doing a study right now to look at the brain and the effects on the brain and to see whether or not that is effective, right? And that's very appropriate, and we want to do that, and we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing. But because somebody says that it works doesn't make it a medicine, right? I mean, we want to be just very careful in how we do this. You know, back 10, 15 years ago, people thought Laetril, which was from the apricot pit, cured cancer. They were sure it cured cancer because some people didn't have cancer anymore, and they used the Laetril. You know, after many studies, they figured out it didn't, but they were sure it did. We just want to be sure in what we're doing and that we're not causing more harm. And that's all we're saying. We want to make sure that if we bring it into Utah, we do it in a safe and effective way and do it in a way that we're not causing more harm. You know, we bring it into the state. We see increased marijuana use in states that among the youth, in states that have this. And we actually are saying, let's give it to the youth. And what we see when we do that is we see increased suicides, we see increased black market marijuana in the states, and we see increased youth use, regardless of whether or not it's through the marijuana card or not. And we want to be very careful that we're not doing that to our youth. We need to be careful in what we're doing, and that's what we're saying. We want to do it in a safe and effective way. We want to also be compassionate, and that's what physicians try to do. So that's what we want to do.
Well, what do you mean? You want to also be compassionate?
We want to be compassionate. We want to look at this and say, is there a safe and effective way to do this? You know, we want to do it through the FDA. If we see science and studies that are doing this, that we can do it in a way that's similar to the FDA, then let's do it that way, etc. Oh, I also wanted to address one other thing that Connor said. You know, he said that the LDS Church had talked to the UMA for the Mattson bill. We didn't talk to anybody from the LDS Church, just to get that out there. We did our own thing. They did their own thing on the Mattson bill. We weren't, we hadn't even talked to them. So
what
anyway,
about the initiative? Have you talked to the LDS Church about the initiative?
Yes. Obviously, they came out in support of our statement. We did talk to them about the initiative. Our concerns about the initiative, yes.
Okay. So you have been in communication with the LDS Church about this?
Yes, we have been.
You, in your statement, you say you're not concerned by the surveys that show a majority of Utahns support this initiative. So I just wanted to get a sense of that. You do see, and we were talking about this earlier on the program, the numbers that seem to be dropping. How are you thinking about that right now?
Well, the reason I said I wasn't concerned is because, you know, the surveys that were asked were, do you support physician-prescribed medical marijuana? Now, think about that question. I would say yes to that question because it's physician-prescribed, which, by the way, this is not. Physicians cannot prescribe it. They can recommend a medical marijuana card. And medical marijuana has a connotation all in of itself. If you hear medical marijuana and you don't know what that is, you would assume it's an approved drug through the FDA process and that you would probably pick it up at a pharmacy. That's not what this is. So all we're saying is we need to educate the public. The public will make their decision, but we want to educate the public about the fact that this is not physician prescribed. And there you go. You know, we've done some of our own polls, and we show much different numbers.
You do? Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about those?
We show an even split.
An even split. So you feel confident heading into November?
We feel confident.
That's Michelle McComber. She's the CEO of the Utah Medical Association and a director of the group Drug Safe Utah. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. Program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.